At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I mean, not personally firsthand knowledge. I've never tried to burn a willow. But if it is a tree that is known for being attracted to moisture, that it would also be a very moist tree.
Okay. Let's try that again.
Why?
The word everyone loves.
You want me to say moist again?
No. I was trying to ask you to reword it.
No, you should have said that because I'll say moist all day long, y'all.
It was quick thinking.
I prefer
thinking.
That to chunky.
It was quick. Oh, gosh. It was quick thinking to bury the bag and mark the spot. He says, "Do you ken that the only time I'm without pain is in your bed, Sassenach? When I take you, when I lie in your arms, my wounds are healed, then my scars forgotten."
So, magic vagina.
Oh, Summer.
Is that what we're talking about here?
No, stop.
Are you sure?
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 319, Shimmer, of the Outlander podcast. This is Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
I mean, so in love. We're a little bit nuts. Cocoa Puffs nuts? Nuts for Cocoa Puffs? What's that phrase? Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Oh, I'll get there eventually. Yes. Okay. So let's get to it. We got a lot to do. And before you get to it with your line, are there any announcements, Sum?
I don't think so. The new trailer came out this week. What is it? The new opening sequence? Is that what it's called? Opening credits?
Yeah.
Came out this week.
Theme, I would say. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, we talked about it a little bit in our group on Facebook. And I
feel bad. Not like bad, like I'm going to cry bad. But I do feel like... because it's different every year, right? Because Outlander, because of the nature of how long it takes and whatever, like actually many shows on cable, I guess, or maybe many premium, whatever channels, unlike network TV, right? Like traditional network, like the big three, It does not have a set schedule. It comes out when they're done filming and they can aim for it.
There's a little bit more into the equation of how and when it comes out, because they do have to slot it in. They want a specific slot. And there are other shows that also play in that same slot. So you have to maneuver around existing shows that are in that time slot when they're going to end. So they have to be slotted in. So it's not just, I'm going to hold on to this as long as I can and then vomit it out into the world. So
not at all. But what I'm saying is, unlike network TV, because they don't have a standard. I mean, like the date may change, but right, they don't come out every September with the episodes, right? They don't have a set thing that we know to expect. So Droughtlander can be, well, it's never short. The shortest was probably the 6-month hiatus we had in the season one. But Droughtlander is between 10 months to 12 months or more. It just depends.
It's rarely a full year. It's rarely a full year.
It has been at least once, I think. But yeah, I'm not complaining about it. What I'm saying is you never know how long it is, and it never comes out in the same month or season consistently. So because of that, it's not anything we can say, okay, well, next fall we'll do X, or next summer or whenever it comes out. It just, like, we have to go with the flow. And thank goodness for Diana and writing long books, because we're paying for it now, but we stretch it out in the beginning and then we pay for it at the end once we get the date. And we are doing it. We will finish. But the reason I say all of this is because this time the next season is coming out in February, and all the stuff they're giving us is their lead up, right? Which fortunately, more like unfortunately, comes out in not so much November, but December. And when anyone, not even if you're, I mean, not even, you don't even have to be a podcaster to like feel this, right? You have your family, you have your holiday, you have whatever vacations or whatever, a lot of stuff during this time of year. And so I am 100% thankful. I am not looking any gift horse in the mouth. I'm thankful that whatever they send us. But I know Summer and I like to do, not so little, but Summer and I like to do these live video chats with you guys in our group, which you can join at outlanderpod.com/group. And so we can just break it down. We're not experts, but we go through what we see, and I miss stuff and Summer misses stuff, and y'all like miss stuff. You guys help us by filling us in. And so it's so much fun. And the problem is, what's the problem, Summer?
The problem is we're trying to finish the Fiery Cross read-along before season five starts, and it's Christmas.
Yes.
And it's the holidays.
Yes.
And, you know, company and yes. All the things. By the way, I've got company just hiding in the back of my house that I've told to be quiet.
He loves you.
I said, go be quiet. I'll see you in an hour.
And so with that, we will try and be as expeditious as we can with our time. But yeah, so I'm saying all of that verbal stuff to say that absolutely this thing came out, and we talked about it a little bit in our group. We shared the post and people discussed it, but we haven't had the time that we like to do either the teaser trailer that came out a number of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, as well as this latest, the intro, basically the theme.
I do just want to be on the record as saying, I feel that it was a wasted opportunity. If any season highlighted Richard Rankin singing the theme song in the beginning, this was the season to do it.
Not just thematically, but also ironically.
I promise you, you would have had every last devoted book reader openly weeping every time it opened. One, and two, by the middle of the season, when we know what's going to happen is going to happen, then everyone else who wasn't already crying is going to cry because they're going to be like, the loss.
I agree with you. And the way you feel, I don't disagree. I still love the choral arrangement, but I don't disagree about the lost thing. Now, what I'm curious about, and I'm guessing, we'll have to find out. I'm guessing this was, we don't know who made the decision. Now
it was intentional, for sure. They intentionally chose this arrangement.
Do we know if Bear wrote this arrangement?
His name's associated with it.
Okay. So if he did it, then it was intentional. It's always intentional, whatever he does. He may or may, I don't know if they give him free reign. I think they give him a lot of rope. And that's going to sound really bad. They give him a lot of lead. I think that production, however, has input into the sound. I don't think they dictate everything because that's Bear's job, right? To come up with the sound palette, if you will.
Well, he does what he does and they yay or nay it. And I think that somebody higher up should have said, hey, I love this, Bear, but why don't we save this until the end of the season? Let's use this and then we'll change it.
It would have been a great season six.
Yeah.
Because season six, I'm not going to spoil, but season six or book six, at least, because we have no idea about season six. Book six, Roger goes through some
biblical changes.
Yes. So I think that's actually a good way of putting it. So hearing that, honestly, it would have been just, I think, everything for season six. But yeah, I definitely don't disagree. I think having him sing something would have been just, oh man, heart crushing and amazing.
No, but think about it. I know as book readers, we've already read that. So everyone who listens to this podcast right now is also aware of the fact that he has no voice. But think of how powerful it would have been if they had used him singing it solo for the entire season until the episode where they hang him. And then immediately afterwards, the very next episode, they had him singing solo for the entire season until they hang him in the season. And then the very next episode opens with the choral arrangement. I'm just saying, it would have been really powerful.
Yes. And your passion for, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. I think it would have been amazing. But your passion for this and lost opportunity is exactly how I felt when they built that fire and played that song that I forget what it was now, the one that a lot of people who actually know and a ton more than me about music and capital classical music.
Oh,
and
how they used that piece, non-original piece.
That was a loss for us all to see what the mother loving F Bear, genius Bear, would have come up with. And I'm still a little bit bitter about that. But anyway, I hear you.
All right. So now, on to our read-along. This week, it's a doozy, y'all. We're going to start with chapter 83 as we continue our The Fiery Cross read-along. Chapter 83 entitled Wildfire.
So, Roger fell asleep with the fire raging? I mean, I guess you can.
He took a little nap. I don't think the fire was raging when he went to sleep.
It was raging, but not that much. But it woke him up, yeah. He hears Clarence, and he smells the smoke.
Briefly.
Yeah. Well, he hears him. But he can't find him. He smells the smoke and chokes-ish. Quote, it wouldn't have mattered if he could have shouted, even when he'd had a voice. It hadn't the carrying quality of Clarence's. Unquote. He rushes off to him, but then loses him. So he follows a possum through the bush, away from the fire.
I loved this. Because this became like a choose your own adventure. Who are you going to follow? The snake? The possum? The wild caribou? Like, pick your animal. Who are you going to follow? It was like, you chose poorly.
Well, he notices water, and it is a stream. Fair enough. It's not a big raging river. But he notices water, and he gets into it. And,
well, he's led to the water by the willows, remember? He saw the willows, and he remembered that willow trees they only grow around water sources, so.
He's thinking, understandably, that he can handle... I mean, he doesn't have much choice if it happens. He would be able to handle the loss of himself, but not the loss of the records that he's been trusted in getting. And, darn it, it had been a very laborious task in getting them. He's like, no, I might die, but these are not going to be destroyed. So around the stream's edge, he digs a hole and buries the leather bag with the notations and marks, and he puts on top of it some rocks, and he flees.
He creates his own cairn.
Yes, he does. Erica B. writes, there's a mention of willows and that they grow near water. Someone recently told me willow is very difficult to burn, perhaps due to the amount of water it holds. Either of you know this to be true?
I mean, not personally firsthand knowledge. I've never tried to burn a willow. But if it is a tree that is known for being attracted to moisture, that it would also be a very moist tree.
Okay. Let's try that again.
Why?
The word everyone loves.
You want me to say moist again?
No. I was asking you to reword it.
No, you should have said that because I'll say moist all day long, y'all.
It was quick
thinking. I prefer
thinking.
That to chunky.
It was quick. Oh, gosh. It was quick thinking to bury the bag and mark the spot. Just so scary to have that much smoke and not be able to breathe.
But he doesn't know where he is. How is he going to find his way back? And they never explain how he finds his way back.
You're getting like 7 chapters ahead.
I
Stop
am.
Yourself.
I know. I
Actually,
know. But it just,
you're ahead of this just, episode. Stop.
I'm just saying. I was just thinking that. I was like, he said he was lost. How did he find his way back? Sorry. Go as you were.
He's fighting physically, mentally, everything. Eric B. writes, what a terrible nightmare having to relive through being hanged. I understand it, though, with the not being able to breathe, then being woken suddenly again, disoriented. So yeah, I did not describe that stuff because again, I what I have, and thank the gods for it, is I have tried, and sometimes I miss things, obviously I'm human, but what I have tried to do going on the fifth read along, since the books only get longer, I have tried to only take notes of things, you know, funny things, you know, things that stand out, fair enough. I'll always do that. But basically, really important things to the plot or the characters or the time or whatever, of course. And also mostly action things. Or definitely I try to get the action. And I don't mean action like Roger runs across the stream. No. But action that is important to the storyline. Sometimes, like the comment with the willows, absolutely, it was in there. I did not note that, meaning I took note of it. I did not write that down. Doesn't mean it's not important. I think it's very interesting. So I'm happy for you guys. Again, comment on whatever you like. But yeah, so if you think I've left something out, number one, I'm human. I could have absolutely forgotten or missed out on something. Number two, I'm trying very specifically not to include everything in the chapter because they only get longer and we're limited in time and all the things. So Erica B. writes, oh, sorry. So yeah, so one of the I say all of that because Erica, one of the things that I read, we all read, if you're reading along with us, is that he is having an, it's a big paragraph or a chunk of paragraphs, but Diana also weaves it through this part, right? Or this chapter anyway, of him feeling different things that he is, especially before he comes to again, he is reliving in some capacity his hanging. So absolutely. And that's not unimportant. It's important for his character. It doesn't necessarily drive the story forward. And I'm I'm trying to like how he gets to the Maroons and how he finds Fanny. So I'm trying to get to there and not describe all the stuff that's necessarily going on in his head.
We can't always get into the minutiae. Sometimes we just have to hit the high points.
Yes. And that's what I try to do. And sometimes I will purposely bring in minutiae because, again, it's stupid funny. Or it's just, provocative or whatever. Yeah. Or if I don't understand something, I might. So, yeah. But relating to responding to what Erica B. wrote, absolutely. Having, it's bad enough to go through it, right? For him to relive this. And it's not just that he's in a very terrifying situation. It's that the situation he's in affects breathing. And, of course, that triggers
PTSD.
Yes. So Roger hits something or someone. And it hits him on the back. He is coughing, and he ends up coughing up a really disgusting phlegm ball. Thanks, Diana, for that description. I did not need that.
But when that started happening, and honestly, it'll come back later. I'm wondering if...
You mean book 8?
No. Oh. I mean in a couple of chapters when he miraculously ends up back on the ridge, and we don't know how.
You mean after this episode, next episode?
Uh-huh. No, it'll be in this episode, nerd. It happens.
Oh,
in
sorry.
These
chapters. You're right.
My point is he shows up and he can talk, his new level of talking. And I'm wondering if that built up phlegm and all the coughing he did, if that loosened some of the tightness in his vocal cords, because having been not able to speak for so long and he coughed up like masses. Like, I'm wondering if those things had been coating his vocal cords and impeding his speech. Because that's the only like real
change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a little bit of time, but we're not talking months. You're talking like a few days probably.
Well, but the few days ago he was having issues. And the only thing that happened between the last time he saw Bree and the next time he sees Bree is that he coughed up several giant globules of black matter.
Okay, enough. Summer,
you're
we don't
welcome.
Need to step on that.
And you know so what? It was all ginger. 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 Listen. It was moist.
He hears voices and sees faces. These people with the faces offer him water. And he's just sitting there like, look, I'm trying to breathe. Like, I don't want to, like, drown, yo.
I'm so glad the faces were the people.
Thank you, Summer. You're
the
welcome.
People were the faces.
So he looks around and he notices that he's in a hut. And most of the people around him were black. And he couldn't understand their tongue, but believed it was an African tongue. He figures they're escaped slaves, and he knows that their freedom depends. If he's let go, their freedom will depend on his secrecy. He thinks about how he should present himself to them and decides to start out at least being a Frenchman. He introduces himself as a traveler and a surveyor. Meanwhile, the astrolabe has burned itself to him, literally. One man grabs it from him, thereby ripping the skin off his chest. And a white woman comes up to him. She looked at the labe and recognized Jamie Fraser's name. And Roger recognizes her by description and circumstance as Fanny Beardsley.
So this to me became a Drums of Odd of moment for me, where remember how none of us realized that the person who died of the abortion was white, or I didn't. And I was like, I have been reading this wrong for years, right?
You mean the episode called Drums of Autumn?
Yep. Drums of Autumn. That was me. I was in listening to this because, I listened to most of it. I did read the last few chapters for time. But when I was listening to this, I didn't hear Davina say white woman. So when Roger made the jump to, are you Fanny Beardsley? I was like, how did you know
that? Girl, you got skills.
I was like, what? I'm good at this.
You're so good at this.
I definitely don't hear the word white, apparently. Ever.
He now introduces himself as Jamie's son-in-law and asks if she wants to know about the child. Whoopsie. Actually, that was not whoopsie. That was on purpose.
It was. And that was a smart and dumb choice.
Correct. Because he could have been killed right away.
Like immediately. Because the thing is we don't, until this chapter, we don't know really why she left the baby. So it could have been that she did not want anything to do with the baby, right? So, I mean, if that was the case, it could have totally been like, hey, screw you. I don't give a about that baby. You're dead. You knew the minute that he said, do you want to know about her, that there was at least regret. And we didn't know if that regret was something that she regrets, that she didn't have a choice to do it differently.
I would say you always have a choice. But yes, she regrets that she had to make that choice. I agree with that. Okay, so there's a quick conversation, and most of the men end up leaving the hut, leaving Fanny Beardsley behind, except for the one dude. And immediately she says, tell me. And Roger's all, not so fast, woman.
She pulled a Diana from A Discovery of Witches, where she just randomly says, tell me, and people are supposed to know what she means.
He's all, not so fast, woman. You get me out of here. I tell you about your baby. So the man who did stay behind says, he's going to rip out his guts.
Well, then you definitely aren't going to get the answer you want.
Kudos to Roger for sticking to his demands, because that is, oof, this is where you get killed in that story. He only tells them, he's like, look, doesn't tell them because she knew this, right? She gave birth to her. He confirms enough to give her more confirmation that he's at least on the right track, like to give them a little more, not information she didn't have, but confirms information that makes her even more willing to save him.
And it's enough to give his potential information value. You know what I mean?
Correct. So he says that it was a girl, and he says no more. And he says, you get me out. So Fanny and the man argue, and finally they agree to help him. They blindfold Roger and they're off. Erica B. writes, the Maroons have put themselves in a spot helping Roger. Fanny is the one that insisted she save him, as the others are sort of hesitant to do anything with him. It's interesting to get a feel for how they live after having had been introduced to the concept of Maroons in Voyager. And oh snap, Fanny looked between 20 and 60. Fanny must have looked rough. My, how quickly the mood in that hut changes. Roger identifies Fanny to the surprise of those around him and then offers up info about her baby. You can tell Fanny is eager to know that she is okay at first. Once Roger smartly decides to use his knowledge as leverage to get out, she gets angry, but follows through with his request. I don't know if it's a request. That's kind of that's what you call a demand.
I stand by my previous assertion that Diana Gabaldone loves torturing Roger the most. Like the most.
Jamie aged out of it.
He has aged out of it. But I mean, she took away the thing he loves the most. The thing he was meant to do. The thing he's always done and has been amazing at, right? She took that away from him. And then insists on continually sticking him into situations where someone is trying to kill him or would love to kill him. I think she hates him most, or she loves him most. I don't know if she tortures the people she loves the most or if she tortures the people she hates the most. Who can say?
When they are done with their little trip through the woods, they take the blindfold off, and it was late twilight. Now, while they'd walked, Roger had worked out what to tell her. He ends up telling her daughter as well. And he tells the man that the girl will inherit the money and all of Aaron Beardsley's property. He and Jamie had gone to, this is more information. Up till then, we've known this. This is more information. This is how Diana shares more stuff that that happened off the page that we didn't know about yet. He and Jamie had gone to the orphan's court, and Jamie had ID'd the little girl, the baby. Richard Brown and his wife were given guardianship over the girl and her property. And, oh, gracious. The little girl had been named Alicia. Note, that was the name of their Prego daughter who ran off with bigamist Isaiah Morton, in case you didn't remember. Fanny and her man argue about the child being black or white. And Fanny says, quote, do you think I would have left her ever if she had been white? Unquote. Now, Summer, I had a question about that. It is, I can see it going either way. If she was white, it would be easier to leave her because, you know what I'm saying? This kind of threw me for a loop. But if she was black and she would have had a harder time, then why wouldn't they have taken her with them?
She couldn't take, because she couldn't explain walking around with a black baby as a white woman. If it was a white baby, she would have taken the baby with her because no one would have questioned her. But if she's walking around with a black baby, people would have been like, why do you have a black baby, white lady?
But she returned to her lover.
She did, but she had to get to him.
Oh, so you don't think he found her?
No, I think she had to go. She had to go find wherever the Maroons were.
Got it. So her, in case she were intercepted in any way, her carrying around a half black baby would have been, it would have been a note. Like, people would have had questions.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It would have made way more of a mention. She would have been way more memorable to people because she's been trying to not be memorable, right? She doesn't want to be found. She doesn't want to be associated with Beardsley anymore. She's been trying to escape that. So for her to do that, she needed a clean break, and she can't do a clean break if she's memorable and everyone's going to be like, oh, I saw that chick with a black baby. Remember that white chick we saw with a black baby? That was weird. What was her name? I don't know. Where did she go? Let's go find her. It's a lot more memorable than a white lady and a white baby, because white ladies have white babies all the time.
Erica B. writes, don't get mad at the color of his skin, Fanny. It takes two to tango. She becomes quite emotional over hearing about her baby along with the baby's father. She had obviously been worried. How can she not be? After all, the baby was born as a result of love. Roger confirms that the Browns will take care of her, and the lover man gives Roger back the astrolabe. Roger promises that no one will come looking for them, and he walks into the night.
I have something to say about that, because Roger was surprised that he would give that thing of value back to him. How is he ever going to turn that thing of value into anything other than what it already is? Unless he intended to use it as an astrolabe, it has literally no use to him. He can't take it and pawn it anywhere. Everyone's going to be like, who'd you steal that from? Even if it didn't have the dude's name on it, even if it didn't say James Fraser, property of James Fraser on it, even if it didn't say that, it still would have been questionable for an African-American in that time period to have a solid gold astrolabe. And that was chapter 83. Moving on to 84, entitled Burnt to the Bones.
Jamie and Claire are still with their horses, waiting out the storm and the coming fire and all of that. Clarence has found them. He's saddled and riderless, and they deduce that because he'd broken his own hobbles, that Roger wasn't on him and thus thrown off or hurt at the time that he was escaping. As Jamie is looking around, he sees white hairs on a nearby tree's bark. It was a scratching tree, so maybe the bear was nearby? This, again, ghost bear. Jamie isn't taking any chances. They're getting off this mountain. As they're riding off, a blue glow goes over everything. Jamie looks at Claire, and he's in the lightning storm too. He jumps at her and takes her down to the ground, off her horse, just in time. And they both are knocked out. When she comes to, she's smelling everything burnt.
I feel like this chapter is potentially unnecessary.
Kind of like Nessie?
Kind of. But I kind of want to see it. Just because I want to see, what she's described, right? So like all of her hair is standing on end and everything is kind of glowing. And I'm like, I kind of want to see it happen, but I feel like it's not going to be in the show at all because it's not necessary. Like they could cut this entire thing out.
The ghost
everything,
bear?
The ghost bear, that whole section can be gone. The burning, the wildfire, gone. In fact, it probably is. But every time I say something's gone, it's there. And when I say it's got to be there, it's gone. So that's all I have. I would love to see this chapter, but I'm not hopeful that it will be there. For many reasons, cost, CGI, it's not cheap.
They'd been out, meaning knocked out, long enough for the storm to have moved away. And the horses were quiet, which only means one of two things. They're quiet or they're not around.
or if they were children, they're getting into trouble. Like Jemmy in the surgery.
As she gets up to look for them, she sees her left shoe and stocking, by the way, had blown completely off.
She has a habit of losing her shoes.
I thought right away, well, she didn't lose them in that capacity. They were taken, or she took them off, but then they were taken. But yeah, I thought right away of Ottertooth. Jamie comes to her
confirms that Judas is dead. Gideon is alive. And then they see the ghost bear.
Or what's that? Well, it's truly a ghost bear now.
Yeah. And they're like, that's good. We're going home.
And scene. Moving along to chapter 85, entitled Hearthfire. I feel like this week's read-along was like two really long chapters with a bunch of short ones in between. So welcome to chapter 85, entitled Hearthfire.
Fraser's Ridge, October 1771. Now it's autumn. The chapter opens and Bree's in bed. She gets up to check on Jemmy. She's thirsty. She goes out to get a sip of water and finds Roger.
Again, how?
Her major realization, other than that he's home, is that he can talk now, or at least talk better. And then we go to join Jamie and Claire, and they're doing it in the hearth firelight. Listen up, showrunners. Jamie and Claire talk about how beautiful they are to one another. And Jamie says, quote, "But I am an old man, or should be. I've white hairs in my head. My beard's gone gray," unquote.
In parts, not totally.
Hold on. How much you want to bet we don't get gray-bearded Jay?
He's not going to have a beard. They have everyone clean shaven. Come on.
Well, when they're out and away for the winter,
they're not away that long. They're not going to.
Jamie just doesn't grow. Sam Jamie doesn't grow facial hair fully.
Their backup plan for that is pube beard, and I'd rather have no beard at all.
7 year Jamie in the cave. That was laughable.
No, I'm talking about Versailles.
Oh. Sorry. Pubic. It was very spotty. It was why even do that?
It was super pubic.
If you give him something fake that looks amazing, don't. Oh, Lord have mercy. Okay, we're not going backwards.
He's a producer now. No more bad beards.
Claire goes on about how she changes the future all the time. With being a doctor and a healer, other people's futures. Oh, Jamie, he says, do you ken that the only time I'm without pain is in your bed, Sassenach? When I take you, when I lie in your arms, my wounds are healed, then my scars forgotten.
So, magic vagina.
Oh, Summer.
Is that what we're talking about here?
No, stop.
Are you sure?
Jamie comments on Claire's hair. And then shares that his own father had unplaited his dead mother's hair in her coffin because his last sight of her, he wanted her to be as she was to him. And then a very sweet line from Jamie, quote, "To see the years touch you gives me joy, Sassenach, for it means that you live," unquote.
You're not going to talk about the fact that they end it with the whole, "until we do both burn to ashes," which is like drama. Well, because it's like, well, he makes a whole thing about, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust kind of a thing. And she's like, is that commentary on the fact that we're supposed to burn in a fire in 3 years or 4 years, however many years it is? And he's like, I hadn't even thought of that. That's morose. Anywho, moving on to chapter 86, entitled "There's a Hole in the Bottom of the Sea." Go ahead, Ginger, sing the song.
All I know is a hole in the bucket.
No, there's a hole in the bottom of the sea. There's a hole in the bottom of the sea. There's a hole, there's a hole, there's a hole in the bottom of the sea. And then you progressively put more things into the hole.
I have never heard that in my life.
Seriously? Are you kidding me? Oh my gosh. How is that even possible?
Literally, what I was thinking was, there's a hole in my bucket or this bucket, whatever. Dear Liza, there's a hole in this bucket. Dear Liza, a hole.
Nope, not that song. There's a hole in the bottom of the sea.
Susanna M. Right. This title is so strange for me. I found out it's a kid's song, but I couldn't understand the connection made between the title and the events described. Could you guys help me since I'm not a native to English? Go for it, Sam.
Let's go forward with the chapter and then I'll discuss it.
Fraser's Ridge, October 1771. Raj wakes up, sees Brianna shivering and holding Jem above the cradle. Jem was fine. She'd had a scary something. And they all go back to bed. She had had a bad dream. She'd been cold in the dream, and it was in the house in Boston. And the baby was gone. She goes looking for him and sees only water lapping up along the outside of the house. It was the sea. Jemmy had drowned. She dives in after him, and she sees Stephen Bonnet. Now, Stephen Bonnet had been holding Jem and laughing.
And then he looked at something behind her that she couldn't see, and it scared him. And that was when she woke up. Roger says, "It's okay, you're safe now." And he holds them and they sleep. Roger and Jamie are on their way to go empty a field of its rocks to prepare it, I believe, for
planting.
Yeah, I think so. They're clearing it. They're doing their best. And as they're walking on their way, Jamie's swollen finger, like he's probably got a few of them, we find out it could portent rain. So they're going out and they see a wild boar that a cat had killed. A wild cat, of course, not Atso cat, had killed.
No, but they said when they first see it, it looks like it's a human. Like it's just a shoulder. And they were like, ugh, what is it? It's a pig.
And so they decide to tie up the carcass because meat. They gut it. They bag the guts and they light a fire to keep away the flies while they go do their work. So now they go to gather rocks, clear the field, and they start piling up the rocks. Oh, and as they were wandering to the field, a bunch of crows flew at them. Remember, crows and ravens, people. Portents. Potential portents. By mid-morning, they started constructing the first pillar. That's when Roger asks. He wants Jamie to teach him to fight. Jamie agrees to and asks why. He says he has to protect his family.
Which is funny because he doesn't even really know why yet. I mean, that's just, you know, intuition that being a man of that time period requires X, Y, and Z. He has no idea that there's already things in motion that will require his assistance.
At noon, they rest and eat. Jamie casually says that he'd had word of Bonnet and he knows where he'll be the following April. 6 months' time, and then they'll kill him. And he says, "Is that time enough?" And Jamie answers, "That'll do." Susanna M. writes, "I love it when Diana shows us the day-to-day activities at the Ridge and how our characters relate to each other. The simple tasks they perform in their daily life to help us get further into the story and sense better the changes our time travelers have to live with. The thing that scares me is after these calm events that I love, the storm always comes. What will it be this time? All book readers know, but we can't share." And then Roger is no longer an academic. He is becoming a man of the time and adapting very well to the wilderness. And he now wants to be a sword fighter and learn how to protect his family. He asks Jamie for help. And Jamie also trusts Roger in a way he doesn't trust other men. Not even his Ardsmere men, by being comfortable showing him his scars. So before we leave this chapter, Summer, how would you answer Susanna M's question? How is the kids' song, what's the connection between the song and the title or the chapter?
To be honest, I think that lives in Diana's head. I just needed to hear all the things that went down in it again. Because the nature of the song is, it's one of those songs where you keep adding on to it. There's a frog on the bump on the log. On the something on the hole in the bottom of the sea. Like it, then there's a fly on the frog on the log on the, like it just becomes, it's exponentially more and more and more and more and more. It's one of those songs. So this could be a reference to the song itself, or it could just be a reference. Like it also kind of made me think of when Claire sees Nessie and how she's like, maybe there is a time travel spot, another circle under the ground where this beast kind of travels in and out and goes through time. And so he's not always there. So it could be, and if she's seeing potentially some sort of a beast in the water that she doesn't see it because it's behind her, that maybe there is something transporting something evil into the water as well. There were lots of things that it could have been. Do I know exactly what it's in reference, what it's referencing to? No. I feel like that is an awesome question for Diana.
I think if it's a very specific thing, then absolutely. Or it's never a bad question for Diana. But in general, I think it's a kid's song, although it doesn't have to be a kid's song or a song for kids. But I think it's a kid's song is especially apt because of Jem and other stuff. So there's stuff we can't say that involves people who were in the dream and something that happens in the future, which I think I'm not saying that she's portenting something, but it could be. But definitely it's not unfitting because there's a kid involved, it's a dream, and the sea is there, right? So, and they're all at the bottom of the sea. So it could mean a few things. But yeah, so it's not 100% clear, or we can't prove it to be this one thing or that one thing, Susanna. But that's a good question. It's always good to think more about the meaning of little things or not so little things like that.
And that was chapter 86. Chapter 86. Moving on to chapter 87, entitled On Guard.
Roger arrives back at his cabin. Again, we don't get that story. Welcoming home indeed. Jemmy is now walking. Bree's explaining everything she did that day, and Roger's sitting there with this big, stupid grin on his face. She tries to get Jem to eat. He'll have none of it. So what's Roger been doing? Moving rocks and learning swords. Roger offers Jem some bread, and we get to hear him inwardly relive or recount the beating he'd taken from Jamie with regard to his learning swords. Quote, "Dirty fighting is the only kind there is. Anything else is no but exhibition," unquote.
He's not wrong, though, when you think about it. That's to be said of, like, any kind of fighting. So, like, my daughter is taking karate, and you see a lot of their sparring, and it's like the whole thing is don't hurt each other, right? So any type of fight where the goal is to not hurt each other isn't a fight. And that's not the type of, you know, potential that this is leading us towards.
Roger falls asleep holding Jem, thumb in his own mouth. He had had a damaged thumb also. And Bree had been drawing him like this when he woke up.
But is this before or after she mentions there's quail for dinner and she wrapped it in mud?
Probably after. I just see. That's one of those things that I did not write down.
Because I'm listening to this chapter. Well, no, I was reading this chapter. I was reading this chapter and I was like, wait, what? So Jamie brings quail and says, here, have some dinner, have some quail. And I'm assuming she looks at them quizzically, like, what am I supposed to do with these? And he goes, just cover them in mud and bake them. But they never explain how you get them out of the mud and also removing all the feathers. So I don't know if the wrapping them in the mud, when you break the mud off, it pulls the skin and the feathers off with it and you're just left with the meat or what. I feel like I needed more explanation. I needed more, Diana.
Well, you could have Googled that, but I'd never heard.
I could have, but then I didn't have a rant.
That's fair enough. And then before they eat, he takes a peek at the drawing and she titled it On Guard. On Guard.
Which I think has lots of meanings to it. It's one, he's laying there sleeping, but he's holding the baby who's also sleeping. So he is, in effect, kind of guarding the baby, right? But then they're also kind of sleeping, so they're kind of guarding each other in their sleep. I don't know. I thought it was a cute little title. Especially knowing that in his waking hours, he has been learning how to fight.
How to sword.
Yeah. And speaking of swords, moving on to chapter 88, entitled... Not, I feel like this is the least
literary
questionable title. Nobody's going to have questions about this. This title is, nope, Roger Buys a Sword.
Cross Creek, November 1771. Roger is, well, buying a sword. He's
exactly.
Right. Quote, how the hell did one road test a sword? Unquote. As he's road testing, he comes face to face with Dr. Fentiman and a sword.
This is hysterical. And he drunk Fentiman.
Yes. Well, definitely drunk. In his cups. We don't know how far along, but definitely in his cups. So this is now at most a month of sword play practice. Because remember, they started the chapter said October. So even if that was I guess it could have been early October and then late November. We don't get that. But it's probably about a month, maybe 5 weeks. After approximately a month of sword play practice, he felt that after the fight, quote unquote fight, with Fentiman had ended, he'd wanted to go on and to hit something. And he'd wanted Brianna against a wall.
You hear that a lot.
Right?
That, you know, war brings on coxhand.
You know. Yes. So he says, well, the sword will do. And Jamie adds, so will he.
What a good father-in-law. But it's funny because they have this whole fight where Dr. Fentiman is fighting him with a concealed, like, rapier that's inside of his, like, cane. He pulls his, like, this knife out of his cane and they're, like, sword fighting. He's like, oh, the first to draw blood wins. And Dr. Fentiman indirectly wins because he tripped and hurt himself and caused himself to bleed. So he indirectly wins. It's hysterical.
Oh, gosh.
All right, y'all, we have finished part 7, and we are moving on to part 8, entitled A Hunting We Will Go. And part 8 begins with chapter 89 entitled The Moons of Jupiter.
And I want to say in my ear, but that's not moons, right? That's tears.
No, that's drops of Jupiter.
Is it drops? I thought it was tears, but okay.
You're talking about the train song?
Yes.
Yeah. No moons of Jupiter. Drops of Jupiter. It would hurt if you had the moons of Jupiter in your ear.
That's true. Ha! Late November 1771, Roger is having a difficult time of this abstinence thing. He's looking at a naked, sleeping Brianna.
But how abstinent are they? Like, I don't think they're, like, aggressively abstinent. I feel like he's just got a hard on and he's upset that he's not being able to use it. Because she's not like, no, not tonight, honey. He's just getting, you know, coitus interruptus from his son.
From the baby. I get it. But it's still a little bit of abstinence. It may not be very long. We learn of their agreement. When Jemmy squawks in the middle of the night, Roger would get up and attend him to his immediate needs. And by the time he brought him to Bree, she'd be awake enough to get ready for him and feed him and everything.
All needs except for food.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So he finally, sitting in this, having a rough time with his abstinence thing and sitting in the bed or lying in the bed next to her, he grasps her arse. And when he rolled back the quilt, he sees the eyes of little Jemmy.
Seriously, that's why you don't have children sleep in your room.
The latter is happily using his new word because he had said,
chit.
And he's, and the way it's written and the way Davina says it, it's chit, 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 C-H-I-T, chit, 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 or chit, chit, chit. She arranges for an Auntie Lizzie break after breakfast.
Yeah, that doesn't work out for anybody.
Right? And then there's loud hammering at the door. It's Jamie. Quote, McLeod says there are beasts just over the ridge. Unquote. No clue what kind, but he's like, this is meat. He finishes dressing and he goes.
But if you saw the opening credits, you know what it is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we started watching the opening credits last week and, you know, we hadn't gotten to this chapter yet. And I was like, I don't understand why there's buffalo.
Huh.
And then I got to this chapter and I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. Welcome to Summer's Idiocy. All right. Chapter 90, y'all. We are going to finish this week's read along with chapter 90 entitled Danger in the Grass. And this is honestly a terrible chapter to end on. I had to flip the page, y'all. I had to flip the page to find out what happened.
Except she knows what happens.
I do. I mean, we know, but we don't know.
There's going to be a book 9.
Girl, but we don't know who, but the people who haven't read all the books don't know who's in book 9.
I think it's pretty easy to guess.
I feel like you're that creepy whisper person now.
The men go in search of these beasts. Roger is aware of human reek. He remembers a time the week before when he'd nearly walked in on Jamie and Claire Dernert. Matter of fact, it was after Ert. I told you, Roger is a creeper. Quote, it was not prurience or even simple curiosity, and yet he often found himself watching them. Unquote. So whether it's his in-laws, Dernert, or his wife's dream journal, Roger doesn't like stumble into something and go, oop, sorry, walk away. Or, oop, sorry, wrong book, close, walk away.
Of course not. Because he's a scholar.
Well, okay.
He wants to know all the things.
Ugh, Summer.
He has to know why it works, how it works, and whether or not he can get his to work the same way.
Here's the problem. Once he was aware, at least regarding the Jamie Claire thing, once he was aware of what he was doing, he kept doing it. And now it's on purpose. But he has a reason. And this is kind of a heartfelt reason. He wanted to know how this marriage thing was done.
He's never seen it.
Exactly. He didn't have a model for it. So back to the men searching for beasts. Jamie has found the beasts. It was a big thing. They have to plan carefully how to approach or hunt them. Evan Lindsay will be marksman. Jamie and Roger will help drive the herd their way. And before they get ready, Fergus farts.
Because he had not properly fermented sauerkraut. Like, that was very specific. Thanks, Diana. That was so, like, aggressively specific. I was like, what? Whoa. I mean, obviously Fergus knew, but I don't know what stinky sauerkraut farts smell like in general, but I don't know what not fully fermented sauerkraut farts smell like either. So that was so specific that I'm like, I don't even know what that smells like.
So this was cute. As they walk toward the beasts, Roger thinks, quote, from his impressions of the size of the beasts they followed, he might even have a chance at hitting one, unquote. Yep. As they investigate a scratch mark on a tree.
There's a lot of scratch marks in these chapters. Roger begins to think, buffalo, and looks up, comes eye to eye with one. His gun goes off, and the beast butts him and sends him flying. And Jamie's all, woohoo! And they're off.
He's like, this cow chase just got super exciting.
For a hot second. Then on the way, Jamie has found a snake and is bludgeoning it to death. And
we find out it
had bitten him.
He stepped on
it. Now, what I find is interesting is that Diana uses, and this is really, really, really surprising, especially it's so much later into her writing career. She used the words poisonous. Remember, we've had, it's venomous, not poisonous. Venomous is, you know the difference, right? Poisonous is if you bite it and you die, it's poisonous. Die or get sick. If venomous it bites you, it's and you die or get sick, it's venomous. Correct. So I was like, I'm just really surprised that this made it through editing, but whatever.
However, she is using their vernacular and they might have used that word.
That's the only thing that made me think, because it wasn't, I don't think it was in the, because she used the word venom. The word venom was in there, but I don't believe it's possible she did not use the term poison or poisonous in description. I believe it was used in their speech. And if that's the case, then yeah, they very well may have not known the difference. And that's obviously okay. But yeah, I did notice that. So it definitely was venomous. Roger does these little X's and sucks out what he can. And I had to like quote this. Come on. Quote, Roger sucked as hard as he could.
Oh, yeah. And he made and it follows by he made a mess of things.
Oh, Summer. Huh. Roger goes off to check on the others. They were a day's walk from the nearest hospital, meaning Claire. So they make fire and Roger brings back the snake and Jamie skins it because they're like, we're not going to like let the meat go to waste and we're going to eat that son of a biscuit. They eat it. Jamie continues to undergo the effects of the snake bite and his leg swells up enormously. Then they talk more TT stuff and whether or not you can change time. Jamie thinks yes. Roger thinks no.
Don't you feel like, though, that they had the conversation that we had like a few weeks ago?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I feel like whenever it comes up in the books, it starts my head spinning again. And I'm like, no, I just resolved to let it go. And so, now it's back in the forefront.
Jamie tells him they could have changed something. Now, we find out momentarily that Roger already knew this. Roger had known the story. But Jamie reminds him that, look, we could have changed something but chose not to. And, of course, that was the killing
of... But what if the choice was preordained? What if that was always the choice they made? What if she always went back? Then they changed nothing.
I'm not discussing it with you, Summer. I'm just reading this, my notes from the book. But he chose not to. And then Jamie gets hella philosophical. I love this conversation as it presents to the reader. I mean, yes, it's about time travel, but it also introduces to the reader the topic of predestination. Now, the Catholic Church, of course, Jamie is Catholic, does not, as far as I understand, does not stand by it, whereas Presbyterianism does, or its roots. And of course, Roger was a Presbyterian. Now, it's possible that today's, like the modern 2019 Presbyterian Church does not stand or no longer stands. I don't know. I'm not that scholar. However, in Roger's time, it definitely did. So I'm not trying to make a religious argument about anything, but it's interesting that their conversation, their sides, if you will, reflects their own religious background and the belief of their religious systems, their religious traditions. And more TT. Jamie says it's only Roger that thinks it's happened. Roger says.
Because it happened.
Uh-uh. It has happened. I read about it. and it's in the history. Jamie replies, that's because you come up from the other side. It's behind him. You might not be able to change it, but I, Jamie, might because it's ahead of me. Oy. This is when it gets a little brain twisted. Jamie says that they have a test soon enough. If he dies that night, Roger is wrong. What Roger thought happened won't have happened, and the past would have been able to be changed. It would have been changed.
What a terrible test.
Roger goes to gather firewood to just be moving. He thinks on the words from Galus's grimoire, quote, right,
and you couldn't change things either, could you, Grandma? Unquote. But of course she had. His own existence was a result of Galus going back. He goes back to Jamie.
What if she always went back?
Well, we're not going to do this. He goes back.
I can do it all day.
He goes back to Jamie, who is not well. And he's like, I'm not leaving this dude again. He starts to make plans. His mind's at least starting to allow himself to think about, okay, what if he actually does die? What do I have to do? Like, how do I handle this? Well, the first thing is I'd have to bury him and I'd have to tell Bree and I'd have to tell Claire. And he's like, he's going off into this very understandably. He's actually not spiraling. I mean, I think his heart is spiraling, but he has this lucidity where he's able to think, okay, these are things I actually would have to do. And these need to be in my mind, at least in the back of my mind. Jimmy says that in case Roger is wrong and he will die, I have to tell you something. Roger is once again in the role of priest or confessor. Now I say that because remember the idiot hut, right? He was with an actual priest, but he was the role of priest or confessor. He could not offer absolution of any kind unless you want to look at some kind of very, 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 very abstract absolution, because Jamie's not saying what he's done wrong, right? Jamie's telling him, he's getting things off his chest, making himself, Jamie's like preparing. He's actually not truly confessing, but this is still the role of a priest or confessor or friend even, or confidant. So the first thing he says is Bonnet. Jamie fills him in on what he's done. He'd planned to send word to one Mr. Lyon, telling him that he'd do business with him as long as he would bring Bonnet to a meeting. He tells him he'll agree in the end with enough whiskey promised. Take someone you trust with you and kill him, Bonnet, at first shot. Also, watch Sinclair. Now that makes me wonder, is that the Sinclair who drew the dirty pictures of Bree?
Girl, I don't remember.
That was like book 4, I think. Anyway, there's a Sinclair he says to watch out for. He says he's one to be used, but not to turn one's back on. You can trust Duncan and you can trust Farquhar Campbell and, of course, Fergus. Be very wary of Obadiah Henderson.
Right?
He continues his litany of Fraser's Ridge and of the backcountry, Cross Creek, Cape Fear Valley, etc. Roger, of course, is freaking out. He is horrified to have to listen to this and struggling to remember it all. Roger is being prepared to take over Fraser's Ridge, everything Jamie had done, except Service Claire. Could he fill his shoes?
Too far, Ginger.
He's to tell Brianna, for Jamie, that he's glad of her, and give his sword to Jem. Regarding Claire, Jamie tells him, quote, tell her I meant it, unquote.
That's a lot, y'all. That's a lot to put on a person. Roger is not remotely prepared to be Jamie.
No one is, ever. Girlfriend.
Ever. Like, that's horrible. And not only that, he didn't even have a piece of paper to take notes. I mean, that's a lot. Like, he laid, and now granted, he didn't have time. You know, if this was the end, all he could do was get as much of it out of his system as possible, right? So tell him all he could do was his best, which was try to arm him with enough for everyone to be able to survive, right? But that's a lot, man. That's a lot for somebody who's A, not of that time period, and B, not already possessing most of those skills. I just wish he'd had a pen and paper. He could have written a bunch of stuff down. You guys, that was 90, entitled Danger in the Grass. Join us next week when we will continue our The Fiery Cross read-along with chapters 91, Domestic Management, 92, I Get By with a Little Help from My Friends, and 93, entitled Choices. And as always, if you'd like to join us and continue the conversation, we have our Facebook group. You can find us there at www.outlenderpod.com/group.
We invite you to become a supporter on Patreon. You can find out more at patreon.com/outlanderpod. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us.
Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.